Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Tactical Exercise by Evelyn Waugh. John Vernet married Elizabeth in 1938, but it was not until the winter of 1945 that he came to hate her steadily and fiercely. There had been countless brief gusts of hate before this, for it was not a thing which came easily to him. He was not what is normally described as a bad-tempered man, rather the reverse. A look of fatigue and abstraction was the only visible sign of the passion which possessed him, as others are possessed by laughter or desire several times a day. During the war, he passed among those he served with as a phlegmatic fellow. He did not have his good or his bad days. They were all uniformly good or bad. Good in that he did what had to be done expeditiously without ever getting in a flop or going off the deep end. Bad from the interminable, invisible sheet lightning of hate, which flashed and flickered deep inside him at every obstruction or reverse. In his orderly room, when, as a company commander, he faced the morning procession of defaulters and malingerers, in the mess when the subalterns disturbed his reading by playing the wireless, at the staff college when the syndicate disagreed with his solution, at brigade HQ when the staff sergeant mislaid a file or the telephone orderly muddled a call, when the driver of his car missed a turning, later in hospital when the doctor seemed to look too cursorily at his wound, and the nurses stood gossiping jauntily at the beds of more likable patients instead of doing their duty to him. In all the annoyances of army life, which others dismissed with an oath and a shrug, John Vernet's eyelids drooped wearily. A tiny grenade of hate exploded, and the fragments rang and ricocheted round the steel walls of his mind. There had been less to annoy him before the war. He had some money and the hope of a career in politics. Before marriage, he served his apprenticeship to the Liberal Party in two hopeless by-elections. The central office then rewarded him with a constituency in outer London, which offered a fair chance in the next general election. The 18 months before the war, he nursed this constituency from his flat in Belgravia, and travelled frequently on the continent to study political conditions. These studies convinced him that war was inevitable. He denounced the Munich Agreement pungently and secured a commission in the Territorial Army. Into this peacetime life, Elizabeth fitted unobtrusively. She was his cousin. In 1938, she had reached the age of 26, 4 years his junior, without falling in love. She was a calm, handsome young woman, an only child with some money of her own, and more to come. As a girl in her first season, an injudicious remark let slip and overheard got her the reputation of cleverness. Those who knew her best ruthlessly called her deep. Thus condemned to social failure, she languished in the ballrooms of Pont Street for another year and then settled down to a life of concert-going and shopping with her mother, until she surprised her small circle of friends by marrying John Vernet. Courtship and consummation were tepid, cousinly, harmonious. They agreed, in face of coming war, to remain childless. No one knew what Elizabeth felt or thought about anything. Her judgments were mainly negative, deep or dull, as you cared to take them. She had none of the appearance of a woman likely to inflame great hate. John Vernet was discharged from the army early in 1945 with a MC and one leg, for the future 2 inches shorter than the other. He found Elizabeth living in Hampstead with her parents, his uncle and aunt. She had kept him informed by letter of the changes in her condition, but preoccupied, he had not clearly imagined them. Their flat had been requisitioned by a governmental office, their furniture and books sent to a repository and totally lost, partly burned by a bomb, partly pillaged by firemen. Elizabeth was a linguist, had gone to work in a clandestine branch of the Foreign Office. Her parents' house had once been a substantial Georgian villa overlooking the heath. John Vernet arrived there early in the morning after a crowded night's journey from Liverpool. The wrought iron railings and gates had been rudely torn away by the salvage collectors, and in the front garden, once so neat, weeds and shrubs grew in a rank jungle trampled at night by courting soldiers. The back garden was a single small bomb crater, heaped clay, statuary, and the bricks and glass of ruined greenhouses. Dry stalks of willow herbs stood abreast high over the mounds. All the windows were gone from the back of the house, replaced by shutters of card and board, which put the main rooms in perpetual darkness. "Welcome to chaos and old night," said his uncle genially. There were no servants. The old had fled, the young had been conscripted for service. Elizabeth made him some tea before leaving for her office. Here he lived. Lucky, Elizabeth told him, to have a home. Furniture was unprocurable. Furnished flats commanded a price beyond their income, which was now taxed to a bare wage. They might have found something in the country, but Elizabeth, being childless, could not get released from her work. Moreover, he had his constituency. This, too, was transformed. A factory wired round like a prisoner of war camp stood in the public gardens. The streets surrounding it, once the trim houses of potential liberals, had been bombed, patched, confiscated, and filled with an immigrant proletarian population. Every day he received a heap of complaining letters from constituents exiled in provincial boarding houses. He had hoped that his decoration and his limp might earn him sympathy, but he found the new inhabitants indifferent to the fortunes of war. Instead, they showed a skeptical curiosity about Social Security. "They're nothing but a lot of Reds," said the Liberal agent. "You mean I shan't get in?" "Well, we'll give them a good fight. The Tories are putting up a Battle of Britain pilot. I'm afraid he'll get most of what's left of the middle-class vote." In the event, John Vernet came bottom of the poll badly. A rancorous schoolteacher was elected. The central office paid his deposit, but the election had cost him dear, and when it was over, there was absolutely nothing for John Vernet to do. He remained in Hampstead, helped his aunt make the beds after Elizabeth had gone to her office, limped to the greengrocer and fishmonger, and stood full of hate in the queues, helped Elizabeth wash up at night. They ate in the kitchen where his aunt cooked deliciously the scanty rations. His uncle went 3 days a week to help pack parcels for Java. Elizabeth, the deep one, never spoke of her work, which, in fact, was concerned with setting up hostile and oppressive governments in Eastern Europe. One evening at a restaurant, a man came and spoke to her, a tall young man whose sallow, aquiline face was full of intellect and humor. "That's the head of my department," she said. "He's so amusing. Looks like a Jew." "I believe he is. He's a strong conservative and hates the work," she added hastily, for since his defeat in the election, John had become fiercely anti-Semitic. "There is absolutely no need to work for the state now," he said. "The war is over. Our work is just beginning. They won't let any of us go. You must understand what conditions are in this country." It often fell to Elizabeth to explain conditions to him. Strand by strand, knot by knot, through the coldest winter, she exposed the vast net of governmental control which had been woven in his absence. He had been reared in traditional liberalism, and the system revolted him. More than this, it had him caught, personally tripped up, tied, tangled. Wherever he wanted to go, whatever he wanted to do or have done, he found himself baffled and frustrated. And as Elizabeth explained, she found herself defending. This regulation was necessary to avoid that ill. Such a country was suffering, as Britain was not, for having neglected such a precaution, and so on, calmly and reasonably. "I know it's maddening, John, but you must realize it's the same for everyone." "That's what all you bureaucrats want," he said. "Equality through slavery. The two-class state, proletarians and officials." Elizabeth was part and parcel of it. She worked for the state and the Jews. She was a collaborator with the new alien occupying power. And as the winter wore on, and the gas burned feebly in the stove, and the rain blew in through the patched windows, as at length spring came and buds broke in the obscene wilderness around the house, Elizabeth in his mind became something more important. She became a symbol, for just as soldiers in far distant camps think of their wives with a tenderness they seldom felt at home, as the embodiment of all the good things they have left behind, wives who perhaps were scolds and drabs, but in the desert and jungle became transfigured until their trite air letters became texts of hope, so Elizabeth grew in John Vernet's despairing mind to more than human malevolence as the arch-priestess and mane of the century of the common man. "You aren't looking well, John," said his aunt. "You and Elizabeth ought to get away for a bit. She is due for leave at Easter." The state is granting her a supplementary ration of her husband's company, you mean. Are we sure she has filled all the correct forms? Or are commissars of her rank above such things? Uncle and aunt laughed uneasily. John made his little jokes with such air weariness, with such a droop of the eyelids, that they sometimes struck chill in that family circle. Elizabeth regarded him gravely and silently. John was far from well. His leg was in constant pain, so that he no longer stood in queues. He slept badly, as also for the first time in her life did Elizabeth. They shared a room now, for the winter rains had brought down ceilings in many parts of the shaken house, and the upper rooms were thought to be unsafe. They had twin beds on the ground floor in what had once been her father's library. In the first days of his homecoming, John had been amorous. Now he never approached her. They lay night after night, 6 feet apart in the darkness. Once when John had been awake for 2 hours, he turned on the lamp that stood on the table between them. Elizabeth was lying with her eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling. "I'm sorry, did I wake you?" "I haven't been asleep. I thought I'd read for a bit. Will it disturb you?" "Not at all." She turned away. John read for an hour. He did not know whether she was awake or asleep when he turned off the light. Often after that he longed to put on the light, but was afraid to find her awake and staring. Instead he lay as others lie, in a luxurious rapture of love, hating her. It did not occur to him to leave her, or rather it did not occur from time to time, but he hopelessly dismissed the thought. Her life was bound tight to his. Her family was his family. Their finances were intertangled, and their expectations lay together in the same quarters. To leave her would be to start fresh, alone and naked in a strange world, and lame and weary at the age of 38. John Vernet had not the heart to move. He loved no one else. He had nowhere to go, nothing to do. Moreau suspected of late that it would not hurt her if he went. And above all, the single steadfast desire left to him was to do her ill. "I wish you were dead," he said to himself as he lay awake at night. "I wish you were dead." Sometimes they went out together. As the winter passed, John took to dining once or twice a week at his club. He assumed that on these occasions she stayed at home, but one morning it transpired that she too had dined out the evening before. He did not ask with whom, but his aunt did, and Elizabeth replied, "Just someone from the office." "The Jew?" John asked. "As a matter of fact, it was." "I hope you enjoyed it." "Quite. A beastly dinner, of course, but he's very amusing." One night, when he returned from his club, after a dismal little dinner and two crowded tube journeys, he found Elizabeth in bed and deeply asleep. She did not stir when he entered. Unlike her normal habit, she was snoring. He stood for a minute, fascinated by this new and unlovely aspect of her, her head thrown back, her mouth open and slightly dribbling at the corner. Then he shook her. She muttered something, turned over, and slept heavily and soundlessly. Half an hour later, as he was striving to compose himself for sleep, she began to snore again. He turned on the light and looked at her more closely and noticed with surprise, which suddenly changed to joyous hope, that there was a tube of unfamiliar pills half empty beside her on the bed table. He examined it. 24 compromis, narcotiques, hypnotiques, he read, and then in large scarlet letters, "Ne pas de passer à deux." He counted those which were left. 11. With tremulous butterfly wings, hope began to flutter in his heart, became a certainty. He felt a fire kindle and spread inside him until he was deliciously suffused in every limb and organ. He lay listening to the snores with the pure excitement of a child on Christmas Eve. "I shall wake up tomorrow and find her dead," he told himself. At once he felt the flaccid stocking at the foot of his bed, and he told himself, "Tomorrow I shall wake up and find it full." Like a child, he longed to sleep, to hasten the morning, and like a child, he was wildly, ecstatically sleepless. Presently he swallowed two of the pills himself and almost at once was unconscious. Elizabeth always rose first to make breakfast for the family. She was at the dressing table when sharply, without drowsiness, his memory stereoscopically clear about the incidents of the night before John awoke. "You've been snoring," she said. Disappointment was so intense that at first he could not speak, and he said, "You snored too last night." "It must be the sleeping tablet I took. I must say, it gave me a good night." "Only one?" "Yes, two's the most that's safe." "Where did you get them?" "A friend at the office, the one you call a Jew. He has them prescribed by a doctor for when he's working too hard. I told him I wasn't sleeping, so he gave me half a bottle." Could he get me some?
I expect so. He can do most things like that.
So he and Elizabeth began to drug themselves regularly and pass long, vacuous nights. But often John delayed, letting the beatific pill lie beside a glass of water while knowing the vigil was terminable at will. He postponed the joy of unconsciousness, heard Elizabeth snores, and hated her sumptuously. One evening, while the plans for the holiday were still under discussion, John and Elizabeth went to the cinema. The film was a murder story of no great ingenuity, but with showy scenery. A bride murdered her husband by throwing him out of a window down a cliff. Things were made easy for her by his taking a lonely lighthouse for their honeymoon. He was very rich, and she wanted his money. All she had to do was confide in the local doctor, and a few neighbors that her husband frightened her by walking in his sleep. She doped his coffee, dragged him from the bed to the balcony, a feat of some strength, where she had already broken away a yard of balustrade, and rolled him over. Then she went back to bed, gave the alarm next morning, and wept over the mangled body, which was presently discovered, half awash on the rocks. Retribution overtook her later, but at the same time the thing was a complete success.
I wish it were as easy as that, thought John, and in a few hours the whole tale had floated away in those lightless attics of the minds where films and dreams and funny stories lie, spider-shrouded for a lifetime unless, as sometimes happens, an intruder brings them to light. Such a thing happened a few weeks later when John and Elizabeth went for their holiday. Elizabeth found the place. It belonged to someone in her office. It was named Good Hope Fort and stood on the Cornish coast. "It's only just been requisitioned," she said. "I expect we shall find it in pretty bad condition."
"We're used to that," said John. It did not occur to him that she should spend her leave anywhere but with him. She was as much part of him as his maimed and aching leg. They arrived on a gusty April afternoon after a train journey of normal discomfort. A taxi drove them 8 miles from the station, through deep Cornish lanes, past granite cottages and disused archaic tin workings. They reached the village which gave the house its postal address, passed through it and out along a track which suddenly emerged from its high banks into open grazing land on the cliff's edge, high swift clouds and seabirds wheeling overhead, the turf at their feet alive with fluttering wild flowers, salt in the air, below them the roar of the Atlantic breaking on the rocks, a middle distance of indigo and white tumbled waters, and beyond it the serene arc of the horizon. Here was the house.
"Your father," said John, "would now say your castle hath a pleasant seat."
"Well, it has rather, hasn't it?" It was a small stone building on the very edge of the cliff, built a century or so ago for defensive purposes, converted to a private house in the years of peace, taken again by the Navy during the war as a signal station, now once more reverting to gentler uses. Some coils of rusty wire, a mast, the concrete foundations of a hut, gave evidence of its former masters. They carried their things into the house and paid the taxi. "A woman comes up every morning from the village. I said we shouldn't want her this evening. I see she's left us some oil for the lamps. She's got a fire going, too, bless her, and plenty of wood. Oh, and look what I've got as a present from Father. I promised not to tell you until we arrived. A bottle of whiskey. Wasn't it sweet of him? He's been hoarding his ration for 3 months. Elizabeth talked brightly as she began to arrange the luggage. "There's a room for each of us. This is the only proper living room, but there's a study in case you feel like doing any work. I believe we shall be quite comfortable." The living room was built with 2 stout bays, each with a French window opening on a balcony which overhung the sea. John opened one, and the sea wind filled the room. He stepped out, breathed deeply, and then said suddenly, "Hello, this is dangerous." At one place between the windows, the cast-iron balustrade had broken away, and the stone ledge lay open over the cliff. He looked at the gap and at the foaming rocks below, momentarily puzzled. The irregular polyhedron of memory rolled uncertainly and came to rest. He had been here before, a few weeks ago, on the gallery of the lighthouse in that swiftly forgotten film. He stood there, looking down. It was exactly thus that the waves had come swirling over the rocks, had broken and dropped back with the spray falling about them. This was the sound they had made. This was the broken ironwork and the sheer edge. Elizabeth was still talking in the room, her voice drowned by wind and sea. John returned to the room, shut and fastened the door. In the quiet she was saying, "Only got the furniture out of store last week. He left a woman from the village to arrange it. She's got some queer ideas, I must say. Just look what she put. What did you say this house was called?"
"Good Hope."
"A good name. That evening, John drank a glass of his father-in-law's whiskey, smoked a pipe, and planned. He had been a good tactician. He made a leisurely mental appreciation of the situation. Object, murder. When they rose to go to bed, he asked, "You packed the tablets?" "Yes, a new tube. But I am sure I shan't want any tonight." "Neither shall I," said John. "The air is wonderful." During the following days, he considered the tactical problem. It was entirely simple. He had the staff solution already. He considered in the words and form he had used in the army. Courses open to the enemy, achievement of surprise, consolidation of success. The staff solution was exemplary. At the beginning of the first week, he began to put it into execution. Already by easy stages, he had made himself known in the village. Elizabeth was a friend to the owner. He, the returned hero, was still a little strange in Civvy Street. "The first holiday my wife and I have had together for 6 years," he told them in the golf club, and growing more confidential at the bar, hinted that they were thinking of making up for the lost time and starting a family. On another evening he spoke of war strain, of how in this war the civilians had had a worse time of it than the services. His wife, for instance, stuck it all through the Blitz. Office work all day, bombs at night. She ought to get right away, alone somewhere for a long stretch. Her nerves had suffered. Nothing serious, but to tell the truth, he wasn't quite happy about it. As a matter of fact, he had found her walking in her sleep once or twice in London. His companions knew of similar cases. Nothing to worry about, but it wanted watching. Didn't want it to develop into anything worse. Had she seen a doctor? "Not yet," John said. "In fact, she didn't know she had been sleepwalking. He had got her back to bed without waking her. He hoped the sea air would do her good. In fact, she seemed much better already. If she showed any more signs of the trouble when they got home, he knew a very good man to take her to." The golf club was full of sympathy. John asked if there was a good doctor in the neighborhood. "Yes," they said, "old Mackenzie in the village, a first-class man. Wasted in a little place like this, not at all a stick in the mud. Read the latest books, psychology and all that." They couldn't think why old Mac had never specialized and made a name for himself. "I think I might go and talk to old Mac about it," said John. "Do. You couldn't find a better fellow." Elizabeth had a fortnight's leave. There were still 3 days to go when John went off to the village to consult Dr. Mackenzie. He found a gray-haired genial bachelor in a consulting room that was more like a lawyer's office than a physician's, book-lined, dark, permeated by tobacco smoke. Seated in the shabby leather armchair, he developed in more precise language the story he had told in the golf club. Dr. Mackenzie listened without comment. "It's the first time I've run against anything like this," he concluded. At length, Dr. Mackenzie said, "You got pretty badly knocked about in the war, Mr. Vernet." "My knee. It still gives me trouble." "Bad time in hospital?" 3 months. A beastly place outside Rome. There's always a good deal of nervous shock in an injury of that kind. It often persists when the wound is healed." "Yes, but I don't quite understand." "My dear Mr. Vernet, your wife asked me to say nothing about it, but I think I must tell you that she has already been here to consult me on this matter." "About her sleepwalking? But she can't—" Then John stopped. "My dear fellow, I quite understand. She thought you didn't know. Twice lately, you've been out of bed, and she had to lead you back. She knows all about it." John could find nothing to say. "It's not the first time," Dr. Mackenzie continued, "that I've been consulted by patients who have told me their symptoms and said they had come on behalf of friends or relations. Usually it's girls who think they're in a family way. It's an interesting feature of your case that you should want to describe the trouble to someone else, probably the decisive feature. I've given your wife the name of a man in London who I think will be able to help you. Meanwhile, I can advise plenty of exercise, light meals at night." John Vernet limped back to Good Hope Fort in a state of consternation. Security had been compromised. The operation must be canceled. Initiative had been lost. All the phases of the tactical school came to his mind, but he was still numb after his unexpected reverse. A vast and naked horror peeped at him and was thrust aside. When he got back, Elizabeth was laying the supper table. He stood on the balcony and stared at the gaping rails with eyes smarting with disappointment. It was dead calm that evening. The rising tide lapped and fell and mounted again, silently among the rocks below. He stood gazing down, then he turned back into the room. There was one large drink left in the whiskey bottle. He poured it out and swallowed it. Elizabeth brought in the supper and they sat down. Gradually his mind grew a little calmer.
They usually ate in silence. At last he said, "Elizabeth, why did you tell the doctor I had been walking in my sleep?" She quietly put down the plate she had been holding and looked at him curiously. "Why?" she said gently. "Because I was worried, of course. I didn't think you knew about it." "But have I been?" "Oh, yes, several times, in London and here. I didn't think it mattered at first, but the night before last I found you on the balcony, quite near that dreadful hole in the rails. I was really frightened. But it's going to be all right now. Dr. Mackenzie has given me the name." It was possible, thought Jean Vernet. Nothing was more likely. He had lived night and day for 10 days thinking of that opening, of the sea and the rock below, the ragged ironwork and the sharp edge of stone. He suddenly felt defeated, sick, and stupid, as he lay on the Italian hillside with his smashed knee. Then, as now, he had felt weariness even more than pain. "Coffee, darling?" Suddenly he roused himself. "No," he almost shouted. "No, no, no." "Darling, what is the matter?" "Don't get excited. Are you feeling ill? Lie down on the sofa near the window." He did as he was told. He felt so weary that he could barely move from his chair. "Do you think coffee would keep you awake, love? You look quite fit to drop already. There, lie down." He lay down. Like the tide slowly mounting among the rocks below, sleep rose and spread in his mind. He nodded and woke with a start. "Shall I open the window, darling, and give you some air?" "Elizabeth," he said, "I feel as I've been drugged, like the rocks below the window. Now awash, now emerging clear from falling water. Now awash again, deeper, now barely visible, mere patches on the face of gently eddying foam." His brain was softly drowning. He roused himself as children do in nightmare, still scared, still half asleep. "I can't be drugged," he said loudly. "I never touched the coffee." "Drugs in the coffee?" said Elizabeth gently, like a nurse soothing a fractious child. "Drugs in the coffee? What an absurd idea. That's the kind of thing that only happens on the films, darling." He did not hear her. He was fast asleep, snoring stertorously by the open window. The Shout by Robert Graves. When we arrived with our bags at the asylum cricket ground, the chief medical officer, whom I had met at the particular house where I was staying, came up. I told him that I was only scoring for the Lambton team today. I had broken a finger the week before, keeping wicket on a bumpy pitch. He said, "Oh, then you'll have an interesting companion." "The other scoresman?" I asked. "Crossley is the most intelligent man in the asylum," answered the doctor. "A far, wide reader, a first-class chess player, and so on. He seems to have traveled all over the world. He's been sent here for delusions. His most serious delusion is that he's a murderer, and his story is that he killed 2 men and a woman at Sydney, Australia. The other delusion, which is more humorous, is that his soul is split in pieces, whatever that means. He edits our monthly magazine. He stage manages our Christmas theatricals, and he gave a most original conjuring performance the other day. You'll like him." He introduced me. Crossley, a big man of 40 or 50, had a queer, not unpleasant face, but I felt a little uncomfortable sitting next to him in the scoring box, his black whiskered hand so close to mine. I had no fear of physical violence, only the sense of being in the presence of a man of unusual force, even perhaps, it somehow occurred to me, of occult powers. It was hot in the scoring box in spite of the wide windows. "Thunderstorm weather," said Crossley, who spoke in what country people call a college voice, though I could not identify the college. "Thunderstorm weather makes us patients behave even more irregularly than usual." I asked whether any patients were playing. 2 of them. This first wicket partnership. The tall one, B.C. Brown, played for Hants 3 years ago, and the other is a good club player, Pat Slingsby. Usually turns out for us too. The Australian fast bowler, you know. But we are dropping him today. In weather like this, he is apt to bowl at the batsman's head. He is not insane in the usual sense, merely magnificently ill-tempered. The doctors can do nothing with him. He wants shooting, really. Crossley began talking about the doctor. A good-hearted fellow, and for a mental hospital physician, technically well-balanced. He actually studies morbid psychology, and is fairly well-read, up to about the day before yesterday. I have a good deal of fun with him. He reads neither German nor French, so I keep a stage or two ahead in psychological fashions. He has to wait for the English translations. I invent significant dreams for him to interpret. I find he likes me to put in snakes and apple pies, so I usually do. He's convinced that my mental trouble is due to the good old
anti-paternal fixation. I wish it were simple as that. Then Crossley asked me whether I could score and listen to a story at the same time. I said that I could. It was slow cricket. My story is true, he said, every word of it. Or when I say that my story is true, I mean at least that I am telling it in a new way. It is always the same story, but I sometimes vary the climax and even recast the characters. Variation keeps it fresh and therefore true. If I were always to use the same formula, it would soon drag and become false. I'm interested in keeping it alive, and it is a true story, every word of it. I know the people in it personally. They are Lambton people. We decided that I should keep score of the runs and extras and that he would keep the bowling analysis, and at the fall of every wicket, we should copy from each other. This made storytelling possible. Richard awoke one morning saying to Rachel, "But what an unusual dream." "Tell me, my dear," she said, "and hurry, because I want to tell you mine." "I was having a conversation," he said, "with a person or persons, because he changed his appearance so often, of great intelligence, and I can clearly remember the argument. Yet this is the first time I have ever been able to remember any argument that came to me in sleep. Usually my dreams are so different from waking that I can only describe them if I say it is as though I were living and thinking as a tree, or a bell, or middle C, or a 5-pound note, as though I had never been human. Life there is sometimes rich for me and sometimes poor, but I repeat, in every case so different that if I were to say, I had a conversation, or I was in love, or I heard music, or I was angry, it would be as far from the fact as if I tried to explain a problem of philosophy as Rabelais' Panurge did to Thaumast, merely by grimacing with my eyes and lips. It is much the same with me, she said. I think that when I am asleep, I become perhaps a stone with all the natural appetites and convictions of a stone. Senseless as a stone is a proverb, but there may be more sense in a stone, more sensibility, more sensitivity, more sentiment, more sensibleness than in many men and women, and no less sensuality, she added thoughtfully. It was Sunday morning, so that they could lie in bed, their arms about each other, without troubling about the time. And they were childless, so breakfast could wait. He told her that in his dream he was walking in the sand hills with his person or persons, who said to him, "These sand hills are part neither of the sea before us nor of the grasslings behind us, and are not related to the mountains beyond the links. They are of themselves. A man walking on the sand hills soon knows this by the tang in the air, and if he were to refrain from eating and drinking, from sleeping and speaking, from thinking and desiring, he could continue among them forever without change. There is no life and no death in the sand hills. Anything might happen in the sand hills." Rachel said that this was nonsense and asked, "But what was the argument? Hurry up." He said it was about the whereabouts of the soul, but that now she had put it out of his head by hurrying him. All that he remembered was that the man was first a Japanese, then an Italian, and finally a kangaroo. In return, she eagerly told her dream, gabbling over the words, "I was walking in the sand hills. There were rabbits there, too. How does that tally with what he said of life and earth? I saw the man and you walking arm in arm towards me, and I ran from you both, and I noticed that I had a black silk handkerchief. He ran after me, and my shoe buckle came off, and I could not wait to pick it up. I left it lying, and he stooped and put it into his pocket." "How do you know that it was the same man?" he asked. "Because," she said, laughing, "he had a black face and wore a blue coat like that picture of Captain Cook, and because it was in the sand hills." He said, kissing her neck, "We not only live together and talk together and sleep together, but it seems we now even dream together." So they laughed. Then he got up and brought her breakfast. At about 11:30, she said, "Go out now for a walk, my dear, and bring home something for me to think about, and be back in time for dinner at 1 o'clock. It was a hot morning in the middle of May, and he went out through the woods and struck the east coast, which after 30 miles led into Lambton. "Do you know Lambton well?" asked Crossley. "No," I said. "I am only here for the holidays, staying with friends." He went 100 yards along the coast road, but then turned off and went across the links, thinking of Rachel and watching the blue butterflies, and looking at the heath roses and thyme, and thinking of her again, and how strange it was that they could be so near to each other, and then taking a pinch of coarse flour and smelling it, and considering the smell and thinking, "If she should die,
what would become of me, and taking a slate from the low wall and skimming it across the pond and thinking, I'm a clumsy fellow to be your husband, and walking towards the sand hills, and then edging away again, perhaps, half in fear of meeting the person of their dream, and at last making a half circle toward the old church beyond Lambton at the foot of the mountain. The morning service was over, and the people were out by the cromlechs behind the church, walking in twos and threes as the custom was in the smooth turf. The squire was talking in a loud voice about King Charles the Martyr, a great man, a very great man, betrayed by those he loved best, and the doctor was arguing about organ music with the director. There was a group of children playing ball. "Throw it here, Elsie." "No, to me, Elsie, Elsie, Elsie." Then the rector appeared and pocketed the ball and said that it was Sunday. They should have remembered. When he was gone, they made faces after him. Presently, a stranger came up and asked permission to sit down beside Richard. They began to talk. The stranger had been to the church service and wished to discuss the sermon. The text had been the immortality of the soul, the last of a series of sermons that had begun at Easter. He said that he could not grant the preacher's premise, that the soul is continually resident in the body. Why should this be so? What duty did the soul perform in the daily routine task of the body? The soul was neither the brain nor the lungs, nor the stomach nor the heart, nor the mind nor the imagination. Surely it was a thing apart. Was it not indeed less likely to be resident in the body than outside the body? He had no proof one way or the other. But he would say, birth and death are so odd a mystery that the principle of life may well lie outside the body, which is the visible evidence of living. We cannot, he said, even tell to a nicety what are the moments of birth and death. Why, in Japan, where I have traveled, they reckon a man to be already 1 year old when he is born, and lately in Italy a dead man. But come and walk on the sandhills, and let me tell you my conclusions. I find it easier to talk when I am walking. Richard was frightened to hear this, and to see the man wipe his forehead with a black silk handkerchief. He stuttered out something. At this moment, the children, who had crept up behind the cromlech, suddenly an agreed signal shouted loud in the ears of the two men, and stood laughing. The stranger was startled into anger. He opened his mouth, as if he were about to curse them, and bared his teeth to the gums. Three of the children screamed and ran off, but the one whom they called Elsie fell down in her fright and lay sobbing. The doctor, who was near, tried to comfort her. "He has a face like a devil," they heard the child say. The stranger smiled good-naturedly. "And a devil I was not so very long ago. That was in Northern Australia, where I lived with the blackfellows for 20 years. Devil is the nearest English word for the positions that they gave me in their tribe. And they also gave me an 18th-century British naval uniform to wear as my ceremonial dress. Come and walk with me in the sandhills, and let me tell you the whole story. I have a passion for walking in the sandhills. That is why I came to this town. My name is Charles." Richard said, "Thank you, but I must hurry home to my dinner." "Nonsense," said Charles. "Dinner can wait, or if you wish, I can come to dinner with you. By the way, I have had nothing to eat since Friday. I am without money." Richard felt uneasy. He was afraid of Charles and did not wish to bring him home to dinner because of the dream and the sandhills and the handkerchief. Yet, on the other hand, the man was intelligent and quiet and decently dressed and had eaten nothing since Friday. If Rachel knew that he had refused him a meal, she would renew her taunts. When Rachel was out of sorts, her favorite complaint was that he was over-careful about money, though when she was at peace with him, she owned that he was the most generous man she knew and that she did not mean what she said. When she was angry with him again, out came the taunts of stinginess. 10 pence halfpenny," she would say. 10 pence halfpenny, and 3 pence of that in stamps." His ears would burn, and he would want to hit her. So he said, "Now, by all means, come along to dinner. But that little girl's still sobbing for fear of you. You ought to do something about it." Charles beckoned her to him and said a single soft word. It was an Australian magic word. He afterward told Richard, meaning milk. Immediately, Elsie was comforted and came to sit on Charles' knee and play with the buttons of his waistcoat for a while, until Charles slunk her away. "You have strange powers, Mr. Charles," Richard said. Charles answered, "I am fond of children, but the shout startled me. I am pleased that I did not do what for a moment I was tempted to do." "What was that?" asked Richard. "I might have shouted myself," said Charles. "Why," said Richard, "they would have liked that better. It would have been a great game for them. They probably expected it of you." "If I had shouted," said Charles,
My shout would have either killed them outright or sent them mad. Probably it would have killed them, for they were standing close. Richard smiled a little foolishly. He did not know whether or not he was expected to laugh, for Charles spoke so gravely and carefully. So he said, "Indeed, what sort of shout would that be? Let me hear you shout." "It is not only children who would be hurt by my shout," Charles said. "Men can be sent raving mad by it. The strongest even would be flung to the ground. It is a magic shout that I learned from the chief devil of the Northern Territory. I took 18 years to perfect it, and yet I have used it in all no more than 5 times. Richard was so confused in his mind with the dream and the handkerchief and the words spoken to Elsie that he did not know what to say, so he muttered, "I'll give you 50 pounds now to hear the cromlechs with a shout." "I see that you do not believe me," Charles said. "Perhaps you have never before heard of the terror shout." Richard considered and said, "Well, I read of the hero shout, which the ancient Irish warriors use, that would drive armies backward, and did not Hector the Trojan have a terrible shout? And then there were sudden shouts in the woods of Greece. They were ascribed to the god Pan, and would infect men with the madness of fear. From this legend, indeed, the word panic has come into the English language. And I remember another shout in the Mogollon, and the story of Lud and Lavilis. It was a shriek that was heard on every May Eve, and went through all hearts, and so scared them that the men lost their hue and their strength, and the women their children, and the youths and maidens their senses, and the animals and trees, the earth and the waters were left barren. But it was because it was caused by a dragon." "It must have been a British magician of the dragon clan," said Charles. "I belong to the Kangaroos." "Yes, that tallies. The effect is not exactly given, but near enough." They reached the house at 1 o'clock, and Rachel was at the door, the dinner ready. "Rachel," said Richard, "here's Mr. Charles to dinner. Mr. Charles is a great traveler." Rachel passed her hand over her eyes as if to dispel a cloud, but it may have been the sudden sunlight. Charles took her hand and kissed it, which surprised her. Rachel was graceful, small, with eyes unusually blue for the blackness of her hair, delicate in her movements, and with a voice rather low pitch. She had a freakish sense of humor. "You would like," Rachel said crossly. "She visits me here sometimes." Of Charles, it would be difficult to say one thing or another. He was of middle age and tall, his hair gray, his face never still for a moment, his eyes large and bright, sometimes yellow, sometimes brown, sometimes gray. His voice changed its tone and accent with a subject. His hands were brown and hairy at the back, his nails well cared for. Of Richard, it is enough to say that he was a musician, not a strong man, but a lucky one. Luck was his strength. After dinner, Charles and Richard washed the dishes together, and Richard suddenly asked Charles if he would let him hear the shout, for he thought that he could not have peace of mind until he heard it. So horrible a thing was surely worse to think about than to hear, for now he believed in the shout. Charles stopped washing up, mop in hand. "As you wish," said he, "but I have warned you what a shout it is, and if I shout it must be in a lonely place where nobody else can hear, and I shall not shout in the second degree, the degree which kills certainly, but in the first, which terrifies only, and when you want me to stop, put your hands to your ears." "Agreed," said Richard. "I have never yet shouted to satisfy an idle curiosity," said Charles, "but only when in danger of my life from enemies, black or white, and once when I was alone in the desert, without food or drink. Then I was forced to shout for food." Richard thought, "Well, at least I am a lucky man, and my luck will be good enough even for this." "I am not afraid," he told Charles. "We will walk out on the sandhills tomorrow early," Charles said, "when nobody is stirring, and I will shout. You say you are not afraid?" But Richard was very much afraid, and what made his fear worse was that somehow he could not talk to Rachel and tell her of it. He knew that if he told her, she would either forbid him to go, or she would come with him. If she forbade him to go, the fear of the shout and the sense of cowardice would hang over him ever afterwards. But if she came with him, either the shout would be nothing, and she would have a new taunt for his credulity, and Charles would laugh with her, or if it were something, she might well be driven mad. So he said nothing. Charles was invited to sleep at the cottage for the night, and they stayed up late talking. Rachel told Richard when they were in bed that she liked Charles, and that he certainly was a man who had seen many things, though a fool in a big baby. Then Rachel talked a great deal of nonsense, for she had 2 glasses of wine, which she seldom drank, and she said, "Oh, my dearest, I forgot to tell you. When I put on my buckled shoes this morning while you were away, I found a buckle missing. I must have noticed that it was lost before I went to sleep last night, and yet not fixed the loss firmly in my mind, so that it came out as a discovery in my dream. But I have a feeling, in fact, I am sure that he is the man whom we met in our dreams. But I don't care, not I." Richard grew more and more afraid, and he dared not tell of the black silk handkerchief, or of Charles' invitation for him to walk in the sandhills. And what was worse, Charles had used only a white handkerchief while he was in the house, so that he could not be sure whether he had seen it after all. Turning his head away, he said lamely, "Well, Charles knows a lot of things. I'm going for a walk with him early tomorrow, if you don't mind. An early walk is what I need." "Oh, I'll come too," she said. Richard could not think how to refuse her. He knew that he had made a mistake in telling her of the walk. But he said, "Charles will be very glad. At 6 o'clock, then." At 6 o'clock he got up, but Rachel, after the wine, was too sleepy to come with them. She kissed him goodbye, and off he went with Charles. Richard had had a bad night. In his dreams, nothing was in human terms, but confused and fearful, and he had felt himself more distant from Rachel than he had ever felt since their marriage, and the fear of the shout was gnawing at him. He was also hungry and cold. There was a stiff wind blowing towards the sea from the mountains, and a few splashes of rain. Charles spoke hardly a word, but chewed a stalk of grass and walked fast. Richard felt giddy and said to Charles, "Wait a moment. I have a stitch in my side." So they stopped, and Richard asked, gasping, "What sort of shout is it? Is it loud or shrill? How is it produced? How can it madden a man?" Charles was silent, so Richard went on with a foolish smile. "Sound, though, is a curious thing. I remember once when I was at Cambridge that a King's College man had his turn of reading the evening lesson. He had not spoken 10 words before there was a groaning and ringing and creaking, and pieces of wood and dust fell from the roof, for his voice was exactly attuned to that of the building, so that he had to stop, else the roof might have fallen, as you can break a wine glass by playing its note on a violin." Charles consented to answer. "My shout is not a matter of tone or vibration, but something not to be explained. It is a shout of pure evil, and there is no fixed place for it on the scale. It may take any note, it is pure terror, and if it were not for a certain intention of mine, which I need not tell you, I would not shout for you." Richard had a great gift of fear, and his new account of the shout disturbed him more and more. He wished himself at home in bed, and Charles 2 continents away. But he was fascinated. They were crossing the links now, and going through the bent grass that pricked through his stockings and soaked them. Now they were on the bare sand hills. From the highest of them, Charles looked about him, and he could see the beach stretched out for 2 miles and more. There was no one in sight. Then Richard saw Charles take something out of his pocket and begin carelessly to juggle it on his fingertips, and spinning it up with finger and thumb to catch it on the back of his hand. It was Rachel's buckle. Richard's breath came in gasps, his heart beat violently, and he nearly vomited. He was shivering with cold and yet sweating. Soon they came to an open place among the sand hills near the sea. There was a raised bank with sea holly growing on it, and a little sickly grass. Stones were strewn all through the place. It was the first rampant of sand hills. There was a gap in the line through which a high tide might have broken, and the winds that continually swept through the gap kept them uncovered of sand. Richard had his hands in his trouser pockets for warmth, and was nervously twisting a soft piece of wax around his right forefinger, a candle end that was in his pocket from the night before when he had gone downstairs to lock the door. "Are you ready?" asked Charles. Richard nodded. A gull dipped over the crest of the sand hills, and rose again screaming when it saw them. "Stand by the sea holly," said Richard with a dry mouth, "and I'll be here among the stones, not too near. When I raise my hand, shout. When I put my fingers to my ear, stop at once." So Charles walked 20 steps towards the holly. Richard saw his broad back and the black silk handkerchief sticking from his pocket. He remembered the dream and the shoe buckle and Elsie's fear. His resolution broke. He hurriedly pulled the piece of wax in two and sealed his ears. Charles did not see him. He turned, and Richard gave the signal with his hand. Charles leaned forward oddly, his chin thrust out, his teeth bared, and never before had Richard seen such a look of fear on a man's face. He had not been prepared for that. Charles' face, that was usually soft and changing, uncertain as a cloud, now hardened to a rough stone mask, dead white at first, and then flushing outwards from the cheekbones red and redder, and at last as black as if he were about to choke. His mouth opened and slowly to the full, and Richard fell on his hands to his ears in a faint. When he came to himself, he was lying alone among the stones. He sat up wondering numbly whether he had been there long. He felt very weak and sick, with a chill on his heart that was worse than the chill of his body. He could not think. He put his hand down to lift himself up, and it rested on a stone, a larger one than most of the others. He picked it up and felt its surface absently. His mind wandered. He began to think about shoemaking, a trade of which he had known nothing, but now every trick was familiar to him. "I must be a shoemaker," he said aloud. Then he corrected himself. "No, I'm a musician. Am I going mad?" He threw the stone from him. It struck against another and bounced off. He asked himself, "Now, why did I say that I was a shoemaker? It seemed a moment ago that I knew all there was to be known about shoemaking, and now I know nothing at all about it. I must get home to Rachel. Why did I ever come out?" Then he saw Charles on a sandhill 100 yards away, gazing out to sea. He remembered his fear and made sure that the wax was in his ears. He stumbled to his feet. He saw a flurry on the sand, and there was a rabbit lying on its side, twitching in a convulsion. As Richard moved towards it, the flurry ended. The rabbit was dead. Richard crept behind a sandhill out of Charles' sight, and then struck homeward, running awkwardly in the soft sand. He had not gone 20 paces before he came upon the gull. It was standing stupidly on the sand and did not rise at his approach, but fell over dead. How Richard reached home, he did not know. But there he was, opening the back door and crawling upstairs on his hands and knees. He unsealed his ears. Rachel was sitting up in bed, pale and trembling. "Thank God you're back," she said. "I have had a nightmare, the worst of all my life. It was frightful. I was in my dream, in the deepest dream of all, like the one of which I told you. I was like a stone, and I was aware of you near me. You were you, quite plain, though I was a stone. And you were in great fear, and I could do nothing to help you. And you were waiting for something, and the terrible thing did not happen to you, but it happened to me. I can't tell you what it was, but it was as though all my nerves cried out in pain at once, and I was pierced through and through with a beam of some intense evil light, and twisted inside out. I woke up and my heart was beating so fast that I had to gasp for breath. Do you think I had a heart attack and my heart missed a beat? They say it feels like that. Where have you been, dearest? Where's Mr. Charles?" Richard sat on the bed and held her hands. "I have had a bad experience too," he said. "I was out with Charles by the sea, and as he went ahead to climb on the highest sandhill, I felt very faint and fell down among a patch of stones. And when I came to myself, I was in a desperate sweat of fear and had to hurry home. So I came back running alone. It happened perhaps 30 minutes ago," he said. He did not tell her more. He asked, could he come back to bed, and we should get breakfast. That was a thing she had not done all the years they were married. "I'm as ill as you," said she. It was understood between them always that Rachel was ill. Richard must be well. "You are not," said he, and fainted again. She helped him to bed ungraciously and dressed herself and went slowly downstairs. A smell of coffee and bacon rose to meet her, and there was Charles, who had lit the fire, putting two breakfasts on a tray. She was so relieved at not having to get breakfast and so confused by her experience that she thanked him and called him a darling, and he kissed her hand gravely and pressed it. He had made the breakfast exactly to her liking. The coffee was strong and the eggs fried on both sides. Rachel fell in love with Charles. She had often fallen in love with men before and since her marriage, but it was her habit to tell Richard when this happened, as he agreed to tell her when it happened to him. So that the suffocation of passion was given a vent, and there was no jealousy. For she used to say, and he had the liberty of saying, "Yes, I am in love with so-and-so, but I only love you." That was as far as it had ever gone. But this was different. Somehow she did not know why. She could not own to being in love with Charles, for she no longer loved Richard. She hated him for being ill, and said that he was lazy and a sham. So about noon he got up, but went groaning around the bedroom
until she sent them back to bed to groan. Charles helped her with the housework, doing all the cooking, but he did not go up to see Richard, since he had not been asked to do so. Rachel was ashamed and apologized to Charles for Richard's rudeness and running away from him, but Charles said mildly that he took it as no insult. He had felt queer himself that morning. It was as though something evil was astir in the air as they reached the sandhills. She told him that she too had the same queer feeling. Later, she found all Lambton talking of it. The doctor maintained that it was an earth tremor, but the country people said that it had been the devil passing by. He had come to fetch the black soul of Solomon Jones, the gamekeeper, found dead that morning in his cottage by the sandhills. When Richard would go downstairs and walk about a little without groaning, Rachel sent him to the cobbler's to get a new buckle for her shoe. She came with him to the bottom of the garden. The path ran beside a steep bank. Richard looked ill and groaned slightly as he walked. So Rachel, half in anger, half in fun, pushed him down the bank, where he felt sprawling among the nettles and old iron. Then she ran back into the house laughing loudly. Richard sighed, tried to share the joke against himself with Rachel, but she had gone. Heaved himself up, picked up the shoes from among the nettles, and after a while walked slowly up the bank, out of the gate, and down the lane in the unaccustomed glare of the sun. When he reached the cobbler's, he sat down heavily. The cobbler was glad to talk to him. "You are looking bad," said the cobbler. Richard said, "Yes, on Friday morning. I had a bit of a turn. I am only now recovering from it." "Good God," burst out the cobbler. "If you had a bit of a turn, what did I not have? It was as if someone handled me raw, without my skin. It was as if someone seized my very soul and juggled with it, as you might juggle with a stone, and hurled me away. I shall never forget last Friday morning." A strange notion came to Richard that it was the cobbler's soul, which he had handled in the form of a stone. It may be, he thought, that the souls of every man and woman and child in Lambton are lying there. But he said nothing about this, asked for a buckle, and went home. Rachel was ready with a kiss and a joke. He might have kept silent, for silence always made Rachel ashamed. But he thought, why make her ashamed? From shame she goes to self-justification, and picks a quarrel over something else, and it's 10 times worse. I'll be cheerful and accept the joke. He was unhappy, and Charles was established in the house. Gentle voice, hard working, and continually taking Richard's part against Rachel's scoffing. This was galling because Rachel did not resent it. "The next part of the story," said Crossley, "is that comic relief, an account of how Richard went again to the sand hills, to the heap of stones, and identified the souls of the doctor and rector. The doctor's because it was shaped like a whiskey bottle, and the rector's because it was black as original sin. And how he proved to himself that the notion was not fanciful. But I will skip that and come to the point where Rachel, 2 days later, suddenly becomes affectionate and loved Richard," she said, "more than ever before. The reason was that Charles had gone away, nobody knows where, and had relaxed the buckle magic for the time, because he was confident that he could renew it on his return. So in a day or two Richard was well again, and everything was as it had been until one afternoon the door opened, and there stood Charles. He entered without a word of greeting and hung his hat upon a peg. He sat down by the fire and asked, 'When is supper ready?' Richard looked at Rachel, his eyebrows raised, but Rachel seemed fascinated by the man. She answered, 8 o'clock, in her low voice, and stooping down, drew off Charles' muddy boots and found him a pair of Richard's slippers. Charles said, 'Good. It is now 7 o'clock. In another hour, supper. At 9 o'clock, the boy will bring the evening paper. At 10 o'clock, Rachel, you and I sleep together.'" Rachel thought that Charles must have gone suddenly mad, but Rachel answered quietly, "Why, of course, my dear." Then she turned viciously to Richard. "And you run away, little man," she said, and slapped his cheek with all her strength. Richard stood puzzled, nursing his cheek. Since she could not believe that Rachel and Charles had both gone mad together, he must be mad himself. At all events, Rachel knew her mind, and had a secret compact that if either of them ever wished to break the marriage promise, the other should not stand in the way. They had made this compact because they wished to feel themselves bound by love rather than by ceremony. So he said as calmly as he could, "Very well, Rachel, I shall leave you two together." Charles flung a boot at him, saying, "If you put your nose inside the door between now and breakfast time, I'll shot the ears off your head." Richard went out this time, not afraid, but cold inside,
and quite clear-headed. He went through the gate, down the lane, and across the links. It wanted 3 hours yet until sunset. He joked with the boys playing stump cricket on the school field. He skipped stones, he thought of Rachel, and tears started in his eyes. Then he sank to comfort himself. "Oh, I'm certainly mad," he said. "And what in the world has happened to my luck?" At last he came to the stones. "Now," he said, "I shall find my soul in this heap, and I shall crack it into 100 pieces with this hammer." He had picked up the hammer in the coal shed as he came out. Then he began looking for a soul. Now, one may recognize the soul of another man or woman, but one can never recognize one's own. Richard could not find his, but by chance he came upon Rachel's soul and recognized a slim green stone with clints of quartz in it, because she was estranged from him at the time. Against it lay another stone, an ugly misshapen flint of a mottled brown. He swore, "I'll destroy this. It must be the soul of Charles." He kissed the soul of Richard. It was like kissing your lips. Then he took the soul of Charles, and poising his hammer, "I'll knock you into 50 fragments. He paused. Richard had scruples. He knew that Rachel loved Charles better than himself, and he was bound to respect the compact. A third stone, his own it must be, was lying on the other side of Charles' stone. It was of smooth gray granite, about the size of a cricket ball. He said to himself, "I will break my own soul in pieces, and that will be the end of me." The world grew black in his eyes, ceased to focus, and he all but fainted, but he recovered himself, and with a great cry brought down the coal hammer, crack and crack again, on the gray stone. It split in 4 pieces, exuding a smell like gunpowder, and when Richard found that he was still alive and whole, he began to laugh and laugh. Oh, he was mad, quite mad. He flung the hammer away, lay down exhausted, and fell asleep. He awoke as the sun was just setting. He went home in confusion, thinking, "This is a very bad dream, and Rachel will help me out of it." When he came to the edge of the town, he found a group of men talking excitedly under a lamp post. One said, "About 8 o'clock it happened, didn't it?" The other said, "Yes." A third said, "Aye, mad as a hatter. Touch me," he says, "and I'll shout. I'll shout you into a fit. The whole blasted police force of you. I'll shout you mad." And the inspector says, now crossly, "Put your hands up. We've got you cornered at last. One last chance," says he. "Go and leave me, or I'll shout you stiff and dead." Richard had stopped to listen. "And what happened to Crossley then?" he asked. "And what did the woman say?" "For Christ's sake," she said to the inspector, "go away, or he'll kill you."
"And did he shout?"
"He didn't shout. He screwed up his face for a moment and drew in his breath. Almighty, I've never seen such a ghastly look, face in my life. I did take 3 or 4 brandies afterwards. And the inspector, he drops a revolver, and it goes off. But nobody hit. Then suddenly a change comes over this man, Crossley. He claps his hand to his side, and again to his heart, and his face goes smooth and dead again. Then he begins to laugh and dance and cut capers. And the woman stares and can't believe her eyes. And the police lead him off. If he was mad before, he was just harmless, dotty now. And they had no trouble with him. He's been taken off in the ambulance to the Royal West County Asylum." So Richard went home to Rachel and told her everything, and she told him everything, though there was not much to tell. She had not fallen in love with Charles, she said. She was only teasing Richard, and she had never said anything or heard Charles say anything, in the least like what he told her. It was part of his dream. She loved him always, and only him, for all his faults, which she went through, his stinginess, his talkativeness, his untidiness. Charles, and she had eaten a quiet supper, and she did think it had been bad of Richard to rush off without a word of explanation and stay away for 3 hours like that. Charles might have murdered her. He did start pulling her about a bit in fun, wanting her to dance with him, and then the knock came on the door, and the inspector shouted, "Walter Charles Crossley, in the name of the king, I arrest you for the murder of George Grant, Harry Grant, and Ada Coleman at Sydney, Australia." Then Charles had gone absolutely mad. He had pulled out a shoe buckle and said to her, "Hold her for me." And then he had told the police to go away, or he'd shot them dead. After that, he made a dreadful face at them and went to pieces altogether. He was rather a nice man. I liked his face so much and feel so sorry for him. "Did you like that story?" asked Crossley. "Yes," I said, busy scoring. "A Milesian tale of the best. Lucius Apuleius, I congratulate you." Crossley turned to me with a troubled face and hands clenched, trembling.
Every word of it is true, he said. Crossley's soul was cracked in 4 pieces, and I'm a madman. Oh, I don't blame Richard and Rachel. They are a pleasant, loving pair of fools, and I've never wished them harm. They often visit me here. In any case, now that my soul lies broken in pieces, my powers are gone. Only one thing remains to me, she said, and that is the shop. I've been so busy scoring and listening to the story at the same time that I had not noticed the immense bank of black clouds that swam up until it spread across the sun and darkened the whole sky. Warm drops of rain fell. A flash of lightning dazzled us, and with it came a smashing clap of thunder. In a moment, all was confusion. Down came a drenching rain. The cricketers dashed for cover. The lunatics began to scream, bellow, and fight. One tall young man, the same B.C. Brown, who once played for Hants, pulled all his clothes off and ran about stark naked. Outside the scoring box, an old man with a beard began to pray to the thunder, ba, ba, ba. Crossley's eyes twitched proudly. Yes, said he, pointing to that sky. That's the sort of shout it is. That's the effect it has. But I can do better than that. Then his face fell suddenly and became childishly unhappy and anxious. Oh, dear God, he said. He'll shout at me again, Crossley will. He'll freeze my marrow. The rain was rattling on the tin roofs, so that I could hardly hear him. Another flash, another clap of thunder, even louder than the first. But that's only the second degree, he shouted in my ear. It's the first that kills. Oh, he said. Don't you understand? He smiled foolishly. I'm Richard now, and Crossley will kill me. The naked man was running about, brandishing a cricket stump in either hand, and screaming. An ugly sight. Ba, 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 prayed the old man, the rain spouting down his back from his up-tilted hat. Nonsense, said I. Be a man. Remember, you're Crossley. You're a match for a dozen Richards. You played a game and lost because Richard had the luck. But you still have the shout. I was feeling rather mad myself. Then the asylum doctor rushed into the scoring box, his flannel streaming wet, still wearing pads and batting gloves, his glasses gone. He had heard our voices raised and tore Crossley's hands from mine. To your dormitory at once, Crossley, he ordered. I'll not go, said Crossley, proud again. You miserable snake and apple pie man. The doctor seized him by his coat and tried to hustle him out. Crossley flung him off, his eyes blazing with madness. Get out, he said, and leave me alone here, or I'll shout. Do you hear? I'll shout. I'll kill the whole damn lot of you. I'll shout the asylum down. I'll wither the grass. I'll shout. His face was distorted in terror. A red spot appeared on either cheek. I put my fingers to my ears and ran out of the scoring box. I had run perhaps 20 yards when an indescribable pang of fire sprung about me and left me dazed and numbed. I escaped death somehow. I suppose that I am lucky, like the Richard of the story. But the lightning struck Crossley and the doctor dead. Crossley's body was found rigid. The doctor's was crouched in a corner, his hands to his ears. Nobody could understand this because death had been instantaneous, and the doctor was not a man to stop his ears against thunder. It makes a rather unsatisfactory end to the story to say that Rachel and Richard were the friends with whom I was staying. Crossley had described them most accurately, but that when I told them that a man called Charles Crossley had been struck at the same time as their friend the doctor, they seemed to take Crossley's death casually by comparison with his. Richard looked blank. Rachel said, Crossley? I think that was the man who called himself the Australian illusionist and gave that wonderful conjuring show the other day. He had practically no apparatus but a black silk handkerchief. I liked his face so much, but Richard didn't like it at all. No, I couldn't stand the way he looked at you all the time, Richard said.